You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In a day where more Americans are not claiming any sort of religious affiliation, you might be surprised that there's also a growing strain of Americans who claim multiple religious identities. For my guest today, an ordained Presbyterian minister who also practices Buddhism, it's not an either-or situation. He claims Jesus as his savior, but Buddha as his teacher. And he's spoken with a number of Americans who share spiritual fluidity, as he calls it, or religious multiplicity. His book is titled, When One Religion Isn't Enough, The Lives of Spiritually Fluid People. Dwayne Bidwell is a professor of practical theology, spiritual care, and counseling at Claremont School of Theology. For Bidwell, it's a matter of his deep abiding interest in Buddhism, giving him a deeper understanding of Christianity, and vice versa. But for others, spiritual fluidity is more practical, in the case of intermarriage, or a matter of safety, when, say, you're secretly practicing your inherited religion in a place that would repress those beliefs if you express them publicly. But for still others, many have a complex association with multiple religions as part of a deeper journey in what it means to be human. And he joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Dwayne Bidwell, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks, Rich, for the invitation.
Your book, When One Religion Isn't Enough, examines religious multiplicity. This is an interesting idea, and it's a practice that I think a lot of people at one point or another will casually say, well, I'll see you in another life. And we talk about these concepts, but perhaps not on a serious level, but you're talking about serious practitioners of multiple religions. What was the impetus for writing this book?
The book really grows out of my own experience as someone who identifies as Buddhist Christian and has done the scholarship of Buddhist Christian studies, but also integrated those things in my own life. And my experience as pastor and pastoral psychotherapist providing care for people whose families manifest different types of religious multiplicity or who in and of themselves have complex religious bonds and are trying to sort through what it means to be a Catholic Sikh in relation to this issue in my life, or how do we reconcile our Hindu and Muslim commitments as we raise a child together, or how do I integrate my cultural spirituality with the formalities of Christian faith? So really the book grew out of my experience sitting with people and listening to them talk about what it's like to live this sort of life. And in part, that's the reason I wrote a book focused on the experience is that a lot of the scholarship around what most people call multiple religious bonds, that I would call religious multiplicity, tries to criticize or critique and norm what it means to ask the questions, is it possible and is it right, before they've really understood the lived experience. And I think we have to start with the lived experience before we start asking those other kinds of critical questions.
And just from those examples you mentioned, you can see that that lived experience is incredibly complicated.
Incredibly, yes.
Well, I mean, if you're looking at a mixed Hindu and Muslim family, very different traditions, how do you navigate them that one partner doesn't feel excluded and their own religious tradition ignored or debased?
And how do you maintain connections to family who have strong commitments to one tradition or another? And consider that an important part of family heritage and identity and the way they know the people they love. But often what I want to do is to say to people, you don't have to defend your multiplicity when we're talking. Let's assume that that's a normal and a life-giving thing for you. You don't have to explain it to me. You don't have to try to justify maintaining bonds to more than one religious tradition. Instead, let's focus on what those religions contribute to your relationships and to your sense of who you are and your relationship to the divine, however you perceive that, and what kind of tensions or struggles it creates for you, maintaining bonds to more than one religion at the same time. And I think when I talk to people about engaging family members who are religiously multiple or trying to sit at the Thanksgiving table as a religiously multiple person in a mono-religious family, what I try and get people to do is to spend time listening to each other, to listen for the values and the commitments and the preferences that are behind our religious commitments, to hear the values and the dreams and the hopes that are embedded in that, rather than trying to start with doctrine, but to begin with the human experience of spirituality, the human experience of relating to more than one tradition at the same time, so that people open themselves up at a human level before they start to engage doctrine. And one of the struggles that religiously complex people have is that a lot of folks want to start or perceive religion as something that has to do with belief and doctrine. And other people want to engage them from that position in the beginning. And for a lot of religiously multiple people, doctrine isn't at the forefront. That's not why they've decided or why they continue to be aligned with more than one tradition. They're more concerned with maintaining relationships and the ways in which they know God than they are reconciling doctrines that contradict to other people.
And it sounds like from the books that have addressed this subject before, doctrine is at the forefront of those, and doctrine tends to be at the forefront of those relationships. How prevalent is this spirit of having to justify your spiritual fluidity?
Well, it depends on the context where you are. Some families are open to it, others are not. Some workplaces are open to it, others are not. Some religious communities are open to it, and others are not. So I think of a woman named Sita Dukaran, her story is in the book, who grew up as an Indian Caribbean in Canada. Her parents were immigrants. And she grew up knowing that it was okay at the Hindu temple to talk about Jesus and to talk about going to church, but that it wasn't okay at the Christian church to talk about Hindu gods or to talk about going to the Hindu puja worship. So that it is something that people have to discern kind of on a case-by-case basis. What are the risks involved in disclosing? What are the benefits involved in disclosing? And particularly for people who are part of a monotheistic tradition like Judaism or Christianity or Islam, to also reveal that they're practitioners of Santeria or Yoruba traditions, that's pretty fraught, right?
Yes. The difference between monotheism and polytheism is a huge divide, I would think.
Yeah, exactly. If you approach it from what do we know about God, but if you approach it as part of here's how I experience spirit in my life and here are the communities I'm connected to, the loyalties that are a part of my religious multiplicity. So at that point, I think I need to clarify that we tend to think of complex religious bonds as something that people choose. And that's true for some folks. But the vast majority of people who are spiritually fluid inherit it from family or culture. They either come from a culture or a background where spiritual fluidity is a norm, or they're part of an interfaith family where one parent is Jewish and the other parent is Christian, or one parent is religiously multiple and the other isn't. So it becomes a part of their sense of how they remain connected to their ancestors and to the people they love on a daily basis, more than it is about what's true in terms of doctrine.
Now, one of the first lines in your book says, we're seeing that more and more people are spiritually fluid. How prevalent is it, and how difficult is it to even answer that question?
Answering that question is very difficult, in part because when we collect information on religious affiliation or religious belief...
Check one.
Exactly. We give people, mono-religious boxes to check. And in fact, a lot of spiritually fluid people have told me that when they're presented with that dilemma, they usually check a non-religious or spiritual but not religious so that they don't have to choose one or the other. So we don't know exactly how many spiritually fluid.
You tell a very interesting story about a gentleman who is undergoing surgery, and he's doing the admittance checks, and there is check of religion, and he said, I think it was Buddhist and Christian, or Catholic, I believe. And the nurse replies, well, which one's getting the surgery?
Exactly. Which part of you is getting the surgery today? Exactly. And then he finds out later that she actually checked none under his religious preference, because he didn't fit into one box or the other. And that was hurtful to him. I mean, it didn't have concrete material results out of that surgery, but he felt like he had been erased. His spirituality had been erased when he saw that in his chart.
Well, how difficult is it for people to claim multiple religions? I would think historically, people who have claimed multiple religions were at the very least considered suspect or, I think what you'll hear today is, cafeteria religion, or far worse, which you could be persecuted for having multiple religions.
Right, right. And, you know, historically, I think of Jews and Muslims in Spain who converted to Catholicism in order to avoid the Inquisition, but continued to practice their original traditions in their home, right? So publicly, they practiced Catholic Christianity, and privately, they maintained Jewish or Muslim tradition in their household. At pain of death, right? There were serious consequences for being spiritually fluid, but they weren't willing to give up what they grew up with, and yet they also knew that strategically they needed to be spiritually fluid. And for some people, it is still strategic. Others, it's not so strategic. It just is a part of their daily life. We know that interreligious marriages are growing by leaps and bounds. We know that there are more children born to Jewish Christian families than there are to strictly Jewish families these days in the United States. So intermarriage, the availability of religious resources via the internet, via the mosque next door, via the person in the cubicle next to us, exposing us to a variety of other religions makes it easier for people to get to know other traditions and to practice different types of prayer or meditation or ways of living, ethical systems that are aligned with one tradition or another than it ever was in the past.
My guest today is Duane Bidwell. He's a professor of practical theology, spiritual care, and counseling at Claremont School of Theology, and the author of When One Religion Isn't Enough, The Lives of Spiritually Fluid People. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the first things you do in the book is you share your own story as a Buddhist and a Christian. Can you tell us how these practices have informed your own spiritual sense?
Sure. I talk about Jesus as my savior, the one who makes me whole, the one who heals, and the Buddha as my teacher, in that there are certain Buddhist practices, certain types of Buddhist meditation that help cultivate in me a type of spiritual wisdom that appeal to me emotionally, that involve my body in different forms of devotion than are involved necessarily in my Christian tradition, which is Presbyterian, that help develop spiritual capacities and ways of knowing that inform my Christian ministry. Likewise, Christianity has an emphasis on social justice and on compassionate action on behalf of others that isn't always prevalent in all types of Buddhism. And I should say, you know, there are many different types of Christianity and many different types of Buddhism, so that it's not, you know, saying Buddhist Christian still doesn't tell us much until we know what traditions a person is practicing in.
And you say the social justice beliefs of Christianity have informed your Buddhism. And can you maybe explain that a little bit?
Sure. In the academic discipline of Buddhist Christian studies, it's often framed as Buddhism is about wisdom and Christianity is about compassion, that when you bring those two things together, incredible things happen. And the Buddhist Peace Fellowship and the socially engaged Buddhist movement is informed a lot by social justice movements in Catholicism and Protestant Christianity, that a part of being a virtuous person, a wise person in the world, is to take action to relieve the suffering of others. That's very strongly developed in Christian traditions, and in some Buddhist communities, it's not as strongly developed. I don't want to paint that to say there's no social justice going on in Buddhist communities, right? But the traditions emphasize different things, and so they can cross-fertilize each other. And I think of Paul Nitter, who was a former Catholic priest and a Catholic theologian who wrote a book titled Without Buddha, I Could Not Be a Christian, right? That practicing Buddhism and learning about Buddhism for him made him a better Christian. Likewise, I know Buddhists who say, understanding more about Christianity makes me a better Buddhist.
Mm. Well, and your writing says, you know, the way of Christ is so difficult if you read a lot of the social justice gospels. And he said, Buddhism gives me a path.
Yeah, the Christian scriptures are a collection of stories and a collection of accounts of human relationships with the divine. And Buddhism, at least the school of Buddhism I study in, Theravada Buddhism, outlines kind of a more schematic path, right? Here are the levels of spiritual development that you'll go through. Here are the practices to help develop yourself in these ways. And here are the changes you can hope to see. And Christianity has some of that in broader traditions, but it's, for me, much harder to follow Jesus. It's less like a schematic than it is an art. Whereas Buddhism gives me more of a schematic to follow that I am a better Christian when I can follow the steps of Buddhism, the Eightfold Path, than when I try to just be like Jesus on my own. I can't do it by myself.
Now, when I've thought about religious multiplicity, you mentioned choice as being one of the three ways people come to this identity and practice. I often think of Buddhism and Christianity or Buddhism and Judaism. I've always thought of that as being something more like Buddhist thought informing and enlightening a search for God, or as you write in the book, mystery, an understanding of this monotheistic deity. And so essentially it's Buddhism helping you understand your Christianity better, but you're really talking about something more in which these are more interbraided, if you will.
Yeah, and different people live that in different ways. There are degrees of religious multiplicity, right? Mm-hmm. And so for some people, they'll have a primary tradition and a secondary tradition, in which the secondary tradition helps them make sense of or live out their primary commitments. And for other people, the traditions are much more equal and very braided together. I think of one person who wrote in Buddhist Christian Studies before he died, who would pray as a Christian 2 days a week, or 3 days a week, and pray as a Buddhist 3 days a week. And on the seventh day, he prayed at a more kind of earth-centered spirituality altar, right? He gave them equal time in his life, and then had a different practice that addressed things that he didn't feel like were sufficiently addressed in either of his main traditions.
Now, when you talk about somebody like that, I can hear people think, you know, this idea of spiritual fluidity is just a way of maybe a universalistic belief or pantheism. Can you explain the difference from something where any path leads to the mystery, as you use the term, or, you know, to a creator or deity of whatever? Can you explain the difference?
I can try to explain the difference with the caveat that I need at least a semester to start the conversation.
I hear you.
Go ahead.
I said, I hear you.
Oh, yeah. There is a difference between people who are mixing and matching to create a system of their own, right? Who aren't seriously engaged in the study or practice of a tradition and accountable to communities. One of the questions about spiritually fluid people is, who counts as spiritually fluid? Is it people who say so themselves, or are there more objective criteria too? Do they have to be recognized and accepted by both of the communities they're practicing in? And for the sake of the book, I accepted people's own frame, people who consider themselves religiously multiple or maintaining complex religious bonds. I didn't try to hold them to maybe a more stringent objective criterion to discover that. But some scholars would. They would say it's only legitimate if you worship at both a Christian community and a Buddhist temple, or if a Buddhist community recognizes you as someone who's taken vows and a Christian community recognizes you as someone who is in good standing and has received baptism.
Yeah. I think with the choice part of this idea of religious or spiritual fluidity, I would think that that is not necessarily the case.
Correct. There are a lot of people who bring in aspects, but they are accountable to the tradition in some way. Either they recognize authority in its practices or its texts or its philosophy and doctrine or in its history, and they hold themselves accountable to that. It's not simply what Robert Bella would have called Sheilaism, right? Meism. I worship what I put together, but that I see these as two complementary voices in my life helping me understand what it means to be a human in relation to the holy. A couple of people in the book talk about it as being like having two parents, and that when you can't really understand where one parent is coming from, you have another parent to consult with. And likewise, you love both of your parents equally. You love them maybe differently, but you're committed to and connected to both of them forever. It's not an issue of having one or the other, or humoring one and really paying attention to the other, necessarily. Someone else said it's like having children. You love your children differently. You enjoy them as different sorts of people, but you still love them the same.
Yeah. I was struck by one of the people that you quote in the book. It says, I believe it's my body belongs to Catholicism, but my soul is Buddhist.
Yes. Hindu, actually.
Hindu,
said.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am Catholic. My soul is Hindu. And that's a really interesting claim, right? And it partly has to do, for her, with her cultural heritage as a Catholic Mexicana, and her personal sense of liberation and freedom that she gained through Hinduism, because it opened things up for her in terms of gender and patriarchy that she couldn't open up within the church she was growing up in.
Let me ask you about, you know, we were talking earlier about coercive forces throughout history that have enforced conversion to the dominant religious sect or practice. When you remove that a few generations, I would think that you have a more fluid religious experience. And I'm thinking of American Indians that converted to Christianity but remain some of their animist beliefs and spiritual tribal beliefs remain intact, or Spanish Jews or Spanish the Moors from Spain. How does that change over generations? Do we have a good idea?
Well, I think in some ways, later generations try to reclaim original traditions, or they're more visible and vocal about the ways they incorporate it. You know, a big part of spiritual fluidity these days is African-American women who are devoted to the church and Jesus and incorporate traditional African religions as a part of reclaiming their heritage, their racial ethnic heritage, their community heritage. They incorporate Yoruba tradition into their Christianity. I recently went to a Christian Ifa wedding here in L.A., right, where the ceremony had elements of both traditions. And that was a part of reclaiming all of who someone is. And particularly in Canada and the United States, I think indigenous communities are claiming a lot more what I would understand to be our either traditional belief or ceremony as a part of who we are spiritually and religiously, while we still follow the teachings of Jesus that we received from the people who colonized us. Right? We want to claim the good in both. Or as a student recently said to me about something, I can't use just the voice of one of my oppressors. I have to speak both English and Spanish, even though my indigenous language is dead. But it erases a part of me to only use one of those voices.
Let's talk a little bit about inheritance and the idea that blended families, people through migration, that they're coming to this from a completely different aspect than choice, for example. What are some of the key points to keep in mind on that?
Well, historically, countries that colonized other places sometimes would demand that the locals convert to Christianity or the other religion of the colonizer in order to have access to better jobs or to participate in political processes and that sort of thing, right? So I think about Sri Lanka, where in order to get a government job, you had to be Christian. So Buddhists would convert and maintain Buddhist traditions, right? So publicly and at work, they would be Christian in order to have access to the social resources and the social goods. Privately, they would maintain their traditional practice of Buddhism. It happens today with Muslim migrants, Muslim refugees going to Europe. There are a number of Muslims who will convert to Christianity upon arrival in Europe in order to have access to services that are administered by Christian organizations, because they think they'll get preferential treatment, or because they really will get preferential treatment. They can't get services if they don't identify as Christian. So there's this pragmatic dimension to it for some people.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and the final way people become spiritually fluid is through collaboration. Can you maybe elaborate on what that means?
Sure. Some people understand themselves to be religiously fluid because that's what the divine is asking of them. They perceive it as an invitation from the divine, and it is the way in which God or the holy expects them to manifest what it means to be religious and spiritual in the world. This is the category that's hardest to define for me, but I certainly hear people speaking about it. And in the book, one of the examples is a Christian pastor who grew up practicing Santeria, who in a moment of crisis hears the Orisha, the gods, calling him back to his original tradition. And he ends up ordained as an Ifa priest and maintaining his Christian credentials, because that's how he can live out his joint commitments. That for some people, it doesn't feel like a choice, and it's not something they inherited. It's something an invitation they accept and explore. explore, trusting that God will be there with them and correct them if they get too far off the path.
Now, one of the things you mentioned in the book is this is really not a complete in-depth description of the way people are religiously multiple or practice religious multiplicity, but I think it's more of a recognition that people do exist. And going back to a personal story that you'd share in the book, is you were listening to a Christian Buddhist lecture, and the person leans over to you and says, "I don't see how anybody could be Christian and Buddhist at the same time." And you lean over and say, "Well, I am." And that person not wanting to have anything more to do with you. Is the takeaway from the book to be cognizant that there, for people who come from an Orthodox religion, that there are people that may share some of your own values, but experience their own spirituality in a very different way, that you may share some traits and not share others?
I think that is a takeaway, that we are surrounded by people often who are religiously multiple, but we don't know it because we either communicate that it's not okay with us, or we're not curious enough to ask the questions and create an environment where people feel okay disclosing. I wrote the book primarily for spiritually fluid people who think they're alone. And in order to say you are not the only one out there, and that there's a whole history and genealogy of complex religious bonds. This is not something new that arose in 21st century America because we have multiple religions present. It's been around forever, for a very long time. And one of the gratifying things, I was at a book exhibit at a conference a couple of weeks ago. People would come up and look at the book, and then they would look up and say, "I think this is a book about me, but I never thought about calling myself this." Or a woman at the State Department who works in the Office of Religious Freedom who wrote and said, "Wow, this book really gives me a label for understanding, a descriptor for understanding myself, and it helps me see how complex religious practice and freedom are, that we don't account for multiplicity in the work we do when we're trying to ensure religious freedom around the world." Hmm. So I hope primarily that people who experience themselves as having complex religious bonds see and hear themselves in the book.
How common is that sense of isolation?
It's very common. I remember speaking about Buddhist Christian practice on the radio for the Canadian Broadcast Company, and within minutes of that episode airing, I started to get emails from people across Canada saying, "I'm the only one. Thank you for giving voice to what I experience. Can you connect me to other people? What are some resources I can access to help make sense of this?" People who are religiously multiple are hungry to connect with others who experience the holy in similar ways, and resources that can help them negotiate and navigate that. That's who the book is for, really.
Well, we appreciate your time today. Duane Bidwell, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich, very much. It was great to have the invitation.
Duane Bidwell is a professor of practical theology, spiritual care, and counseling at Claremont School of Theology in California, and the author of When One Religion Isn't Enough, The Lives of Spiritually Fluid People. It's published by Beacon Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.